Mr. Sarles?
May it please the court. Appellant Doskasil Manufacturing Company in Arlington manufactures pet products sold under the PetMate brand name that you may see in stores. Doskasil is a non-subscriber to the optional Texas Workers' Compensation Act. Instead, it offers its employees in the state of Texas benefits through its Federal Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, ERISA, plan for occupational injuries and diseases. Doskasil employees wishing to participate in the plan and be eligible for its benefits are given the option to sign an arbitration agreement and agree with the company to mediate and arbitrate disputes.
Let me ask you about that arbitration agreement. It's also a waiver in arbitration agreement, a waiver of any right to sue for claims for negligence or personal injuries. Now, as I understand it, do you think that that waiver provision is still good law?
That's an issue that I believe, yes, Justice Kerr, I believe it is still enforceable, although the folks that passed that legislation in June of 2001 in the Texas legislature might disagree with me. I believe the contracts provision in the Texas Bill of Rights, the Constitution, guarantees the absence of interference by the legislature in existing contracts. So I believe that the waiver is enforceable. We've not asserted the waiver here. Our position would be that argument would have to be left up to the arbitrator. There are some cases that are out there that have determined that if the injury, including the Texas Supreme Court, frankly, that if the injury occurs after the June 17, 2001 amendment to Section 406.033 of the Texas Labor Code, if the date of injury is post June 17, 2001, then the waiver is not enforceable.
Has Doskasil changed its employment agreement since then in response to that labor code amendment?
It has, Your Honor. The document has been changed to delete that waiver. This is an unusual case because Ms. Wynn signed this document in January of 2001, and then it sat in the personnel file for the better part of more than 15 years before this issue came up.
I had a question about your summary plan description.
Yes, Your Honor. It's in a portion of the plan description.
Yes. And part of the plan description in paragraph 2B follows that waiver of personal injury and death claims. And then it says mutual arbitration of all other types of disputes, which suggests to me, just reading that perhaps somebody looking at that would think, okay, I have to arbitrate something like, you know, did I not get paid for overtime or something like that. But do you think that this part of the summary plan description would signal to somebody, conversant in English or not, that in fact they were agreeing to arbitrate a personal injury claim?
Well, I believe it does, Your Honor, because there are some parentheticals. If you have this is in the appendix at clerk's record, page 60. It's the second of four pages of the actual waiver and arbitration agreement. It's mutual promises to resolve claims by binding arbitration. That paragraph, I drafted this document 20 years ago, that paragraph specifically has a parenthetical in it about the fourth line of that mutual promises to resolve claims by binding arbitration, the parenthetical being including any on-the-job injury claims not validly released and waived by the preceding section of this agreement.
So why would Doskasil not want to take the position? Wouldn't it be a lot cleaner to get rid of this case if you said she'd waived all these claims? Thank you very much.
If they did that and invoked the jurisdiction of the court, filed a summary judgment motion on the waiver issue, I think that would certainly waive by litigation conduct Doskasil's right to arbitrate the dispute. So if the waiver is valid or not invalid, Doskasil's preference would be to be in arbitration and let the AAA arbitrator determine whether the waiver is valid or it's not invalid. And if it's not invalid, then determine the substance of Ms. Wynn's occupational disease claim, negligence claim. The case raises a number of issues we believe that are encompassed and that the result in this action essentially flows inexorably from the United States Supreme Court's 2010 decision in the Rent-A-Center West versus Jackson case. The undisputed facts, there are some disputes about Ms. Wynn's ability to read English and translators and what was translated and what wasn't translated, and there certainly we would submit some differences, stark differences, between her testimony and her affidavit that was submitted in support of the motion to set aside the arbitration agreement and her testimony in the hearing before the trial court. But those issues, we believe, are essentially irrelevant and immaterial to the case, and that the undisputed facts, just a few of which, we believe, make them outcome determinative for this appeal. First of all, as set forth in the trial court's letter opinion, it is undisputed that Ms. Wynn, on January 11, 2001, signed the document. There is no dispute in this case that that is her signature on the fourth page of the agreement. She signed the document, and although unusual that she claims that she didn't understand the document in any way, shape, or form, she signed it on the right line. She put her DOSCASIL employee ID number there. She put her printed her name on the printed line portion. She put the date in that she had signed the document. And she had all of that witnessed by two other DOSCASIL employees, and then it was filed away for the better part of 15 years. This is not a case where there is a contention about whether she signed the agreement or not. So this distinguishes it, we believe, in a significant material way from other cases where motions to compel in similar circumstances have been denied for the lack of the existence of an agreement. Here we believe, as the El Paso Court of Appeals held for me in a case a dozen years ago, In Re Big Eight Food Stores, that signatures on an agreement to arbitrate by an employee, Spanish-speaking employee who contends that she doesn't understand English, that signature constitutes powerful evidence that the person actually understand the agreement, or they wouldn't have put their signature on it. Secondly, we believe it's undisputed in this case, at this posture before the court, that the Federal Arbitration Act applies here. Paragraph 4.17 of the plaintiff's original petition, and repeated on page 16 of Appley's brief to this court, says that DOSCASIL is involved in interstate commerce because it specifically alleges that DOSCASIL placed products into interstate commerce in California, where it also does business, allegedly containing this carcinogen DEHP that Ms. Wynn contends is the cause of her oral and throat cancer. Secondly, as in the Big Eight Food Stores case and a number of other cases that we've cited from the Texas Supreme Court on page 24 of appellant's brief, the arbitration procedures that are incorporated into this document expressly stipulate to DOSCASIL's involvement in interstate commerce and to the employee's employment's involvement in interstate commerce. And as those cases that we've cited in our briefing point out, the parties can certainly agree, without the showing of interstate commerce, that the Federal Arbitration Act applies. Thirdly, we believe it's undisputed and that there is no record evidence whatsoever that Ms. Wynn, on January 11, 2001, was mentally incompetent. The trial court's decision, based on the In re Morgan Stanley case, a case that we believe is clearly distinguishable. The plaintiff in that case had been diagnosed with dementia, and a court-appointed guardian had actually been involved in the case, appointed for the person to that agreement. There's no question here that Ms. Wynn was at least competent as of the date of the trial court hearing, because she took the oath, was offered to testify as a witness by her counsel, and essentially that constitutes, under the case law that we've cited, a representation to the court that she's competent to testify when you offer that testimony in an evidentiary hearing. So there is no evidence that the case that the plaintiff in this case, the appellee here, relies upon, that In re Morgan Stanley case, is relevant to the case because there's no evidence of mental incapacity or mental incompetency. There's also no evidence in the record that Ms. Wynn was rushed, pressured, or coerced into opting to accept the arbitration agreement's terms. It would really make no sense for Doskozil to pressure or coerce or rush an employee to do so, because the agreement that we've already looked at has on its last page a 5-day revocation right for the employee to essentially exercise a sort of buyer's remorse provision and opt out of the agreement after they've signed it. So Ms. Nguyen had till January 16th of 2001 to opt out of this agreement. She chose not to do that. It seems to us fairly clearly from the absence of testimony, either in Ms. Nguyen's affidavit or in her live testimony of the trial court, that there was any type of coercion, duress, pressure applied to her. And we believe that distinguishes the only cases cited by the appellee in this case, the Prevost case from former Judge Kent in Galveston in the Southern District, and the Henry Turner Brothers case from the Texarkana Court of Appeals a number of years ago, where in those cases there was pressure applied to the employee. There is simply no evidence of that here. There is no finding by the trial court on those elements in her letter opinion to the party's counsel explaining her decision. There is nothing before this court that would indicate that she was pressured, coerced, hurried in any way. There is no evidence that Ms. Nguyen was lied to about what she was signing. When I asked her on cross-examination at the evidentiary hearing before the court, do you believe that there is anything that someone lied to you about this document? She gave me an answer that said something about she needed to sign it because she was an employee, but she failed to endorse, given the opportunity, she failed to endorse the concept of some type of trick, artifice, deceit, misrepresentation, all of those kinds of concepts that Texas law says are necessary for an employee, whether he or she is illiterate, whether he or she is illiterate in the English language. The only way you get out of an agreement under Texas law, once your signature is applied to that document, is proof of one of those affirmative defenses that she bore the burden of proof on, as Justice Gabriel's opinion in the Brand FX versus Ryan case a couple of years ago makes very clear, following Texas Supreme Court case law, that those affirmative defenses, things like trick, artifice, deceit, trickery, all of those types of affirmative defenses to the enforcement of an arbitration agreement are affirmative defenses on which the non-movement bears the burden of proof. Again, there are no findings. There is no mention of that concept in the trial court's orders or letter opinion. Finally, there's no evidence in this case that Ms. Nguyen had anything untoward occur to her, other than her claim currently that no one explained the agreement. There's no argument really essentially in the motion to set aside the arbitration agreement, in the post-briefing that the parties did, appellee's counsel by letter brief, my part by a formal filing of a response to that letter brief. There is no evidence in the case that anything happened to Ms. Nguyen other than she now contends, 15 years after the fact, that she didn't understand the agreement. The delegation clause in this case is identical to the delegation clauses in two cases. Some of the members of this court have cited those cases in other opinions. The IHS acquisition case versus Iteraldi and the IHS acquisition case versus Beatty Ortiz from the El Paso Court of Appeals in 2012. Our delegation clause before this court is identical, word for word, to the delegation clause that is at issue here. The delegation clause here is also identical to the Fifth Circuit case that I had before the Fifth Circuit in 2014, Aviles versus Russell Stover Candies. So the a decision that the delegation clause would somehow be ambiguous or different and not enforceable would essentially create a court of appeals split.
Let me jump to one of your arguments that you've not yet mentioned yet, and that's under the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, Section 171.025. If this court were to agree with you that that was an automatic stay, I assume that that would be a question that we would consider under a de novo standard of review. And if we agreed with you, wouldn't that, doesn't that, isn't that dispositive?
Well, Your Honor, logically, it's one of those cart before the horses things. We believe that the first order, which I believe was a September 30th of 2016 order, was the order on Appley's motion to set aside the arbitration agreement. My position is that until Doskasil's pending application for order for arbitration, it was filed with the answer, was decided, the stay was in effect. And so my position is that you have to rule on the application for order for arbitration before, I'm out of time, but if I might finish the answer, if the court had done it in the order that I believe would have been proper and permissible, there would have had to have been a ruling on our application for order for arbitration under section 171.025 to deny the application for order for arbitration, and then the trial court could have proceeded to Appley's motion to set aside the arbitration agreement. The somewhat disturbing and certainly unusual aspect of this case is that our Doskasil's application for order for arbitration was never set for hearing.
We never. It's because you didn't ask that it be set.
I didn't ask that it be set. My position was it was stayed. It didn't ask for it to be set, but it wasn't submitted. There wasn't any notice that it would be submitted. But in answer to your question, Justice Gabriel, I think that all that would do would be to invalidate the first order, the order granting their motion to set aside the arbitration agreement. I don't know that the trial court, I don't know that there's any specific rule that the trial court wouldn't be able to deny that application as she did, essentially on the papers, without any type of argument or submission formally to her, like a summary judgment submission that would be bound by certain rules because of the way the Houston courts have so long submitted summary judgment motions on submissions rather than oral arguments. So I'm not sure that it would invalidate the second order that denies Doskasil's application for order for arbitration.
Okay, thank you. Masterson?
Thank you. I'm Bill Masterson with the firm of Kilgore & Kilgore, and this is Ted Anderson, my partner, who's here today. I would like to offer argument to the court on 3 points, which I think respond basically to the argument that Doskasil has made. And the first point is that in this case, the trial judge found as a fact that there was no clear and unmistakable evidence of an intent to arbitrate. And that actually is the basis for the decision by the trial court, and that's point four of the appellant's brief. Second, the trial court's order, we believe, was not void because of the automatic stay of CPRC 171.025, and that's point one of the appellant's brief. Finally, this court's decision in Haddock v. Quinn, we believe, controls with respect to the delegation clause issue in this case, and I believe that covers points two and three of the appellant's brief. I think this is an unusual case in that the trial judge actually wrote an opinion that had a finding of fact in it. And the opinion obviously was composed by Judge McCoy. It wasn't there wasn't something rendered based on forms submitted by counsel on either side. And in that opinion, it found as a fact that there was no clear and unmistakable evidence that the plaintiff intended to arbitrate the arbitrability under the waiver and arbitration agreement.
Is it your position that Judge McCoy would have found that only because Ms. Nguyen didn't speak English, or is there something else? I mean, do you think that there's something about the language of the documents themselves that doesn't evidence a clear intent to arbitrate?
I think it's the totality of the circumstances. And as Doskasil pointed out in their brief, there's some inconsistencies in her testimony, all of which was through an interpreter. So there's that additional issue here. But the testimony was simply not clear. For example, Mr. Sarles asked, did you sign the agreement? And I believe voluntarily or something to that effect. And I believe she said, well, I was an employee of the company. And so apparently she was just assuming that if you're an employee, you're subject to whatever, all agreements that are out there. So I don't think it was any one point. I think it was just the totality of all the circumstances that came up in the testimony. And another issue that came up in the testimony was she was supposed to get, as consideration for this waiver, access to some health plan. And it turned out that all she ever got was some payment from an insurance company where she paid the premiums. So that's another point.
There was no finding of any kind of fraud or deceit or misrepresentation. Judge McCoy didn't find any of that.
No, there are no findings. The only finding is that there was no clear and unmistakable intent to arbitrate, which is from both the federal and the state cases and the cases by this court.
Do you have any cases in which a plaintiff's mere inability to understand the English language without more, such as pressure of some sort, do you have any case where simply the language barrier in and of itself voids an arbitration agreement that might otherwise be enforceable?
Well, we have three cases. The Prevost v. Phillips case, which is a federal case. I don't recall that there was any kind of pressure in that case. The agreement was in English, which the plaintiff could not read. And then the Turner Brothers trucking case from Texarkana Court of Appeals, the employee was illiterate. The agreement was not explained, and there was some mention of pressure to sign as part of the totality of the circumstances. And then Delfingen versus Valenzuela, my notes on the case is that there was no explanation, discussion, or translation. I don't remember there being any pressure in that case. So there are two out of the three where that was not an element, and I think those three cases are the most applicable of the cases that are out there.
But aren't there other cases that say if you sign a document, even if you don't speak English, if you sign it, there's a presumption that you're bound by what's in it?
If there's a clear and unmistakable evidence of an intent to arbitrate.
Isn't that kind of circular?
Yeah,
sorry.
Isn't there a difference? Because Judge McCoy's words were, she did not demonstrate the clear and unmistakable evidence that she intended to arbitrate arbitrability issues. But the case law says that there has to be clear and unmistakable evidence of an agreement. So the language in the agreement itself has to be clear and unmistakable that there is an agreement to arbitrate arbitrability. What Judge McCoy found is that there wasn't clear and unmistakable evidence that she understood that. There's a difference, isn't there?
Well, if there is a difference, then her finding that there's no unmistakable, clear and unmistakable intent would be the critical finding under the Morgan's.
Trumps that there is an agreement there. It's a clear and unmistakable, let's just say for argument's purposes, there's a clear and unmistakable agreement there in the written documentation. She just didn't understand it. So anytime anybody didn't understand it, even if it was clear and unmistakable, that
she didn't understand it. She didn't speak English. It wasn't translated for her. It wasn't explained to her. It wasn't. There was a waiver of valuable rights and no explanation that we know of in the record.
But she did have a 5-day period in which she could have had somebody translate it for her, read it to her.
Theoretically.
Theoretically, at least.
And didn't she have the right to take it home before she signed it?
She may have had a right. I don't think that was the circumstance. May I say to the court that in the Morgan Stanley case, under Section 3, Roman 3, Judge Medina said these cases fall into three categories. He analyzed Prima Paint. He had analyzed Buckeye cash checking. And he came up, which is the imprimatur by the Supreme Court of what you do in a case like this and what categories there are. The first category is where you're attacking the agreement itself. And that is for the arbitrator That is a situation where you do have an agreement, you do have a signature, but you're saying that it's no good because it was procured by fraud, or it's an illegal contract. Those are two instances that Justice Medina discussed in the opinion. Now, the second category that he comes up with is where you attack just the delegation clause. And the third category is a new category, which he says is the category which the cases are now developing after these leading Supreme Court cases. And that's the category where there was never a contract to arbitrate that was established. There was no clear and unmistakable intent, and that's category three, and I think that's clearly where we are in this case. So if you follow the way that he analyzed it, and there was only one dissent in that case, I think the case is much broader than just an incompetent who's suffering from dementia. I think it's a person who is unable to form a clear and unmistakable intent to arbitrate. And I think that's what this case is, and that's what Judge McCoy found, and that's what she held.
If we were to follow that line of thinking and broaden, let's say, the idea that something beyond just mental incapacity would work to get out of an arbitration clause, I mean, would that not just sort of open the floodgates for anybody who doesn't want to go to arbitration to make all kinds of claims about what they didn't understand?
No, I don't think it would, because in Category 1, which goes to the arbitrator, you've got cases of fraud by inducement. You've got cases where the illegal contract defense is raised. Those, obviously, whatever else you think about those particular cases in those particular categories, are going to be in that category that it does go to the arbitrator to determine arbitrability under that analysis, which is a new form of analysis that's been adopted by the Supreme Court, and I think that this case falls within Category 3.
So you're saying there's no agreement?
No, I'm not saying there is a signed paper. I'm saying there is no clear and unmistakable intent to arbitrate. Same thing that Judge McCoy said. And that puts it...
And that's what Morgan Stanley says.
That's what puts it in Category 3, under Section Roman 3 of the opinion. It's the first paragraph where Justice Medina makes this analysis of the recent federal cases, and he cites a lot of state cases. There are lots of footnotes in that case. And that's what he comes up with, and I think that's where we... That's where we are under the law today, and hopefully this case will be in that Category 3 and will be handled in that way. Now, I would like to mention, Justice Gabriel, you mentioned the CPRC 171.025 issue. And I would like to point out that the first case that is cited by the appellee there is actually, I think, contrary to what the citation is. It is the Nationwide Credit case. And in that case, you had a class action. The facts are a little bit involved, but I think they can be pretty quickly stated. There, in that case, there was a class action where the class representative held a mediation on his claim, and in that mediation agreement, there was an arbitration clause. So you moved the class representative's claim over into arbitration. Now that leaves the class sitting in the court, and the court entered a class notice order, which was appealed, and the court said, no, you can't do that because you've got this stay under 171.025. But, and here's where I think It makes it clear that that what Doskozil is claiming is not the case, but you can entertain a motion to have this class representative removed, a new class representative appointed, and then that case can go forward without any problem, because nobody then in the suit would have an arbitration agreement. So I think it's clear that stay is not a broad, universal, all-encompassing stay. And the motion that was heard by Judge McCoy was actually the converse of their motion, which, has been established, they did not ever cite.
Was there a procedural reason why, instead of filing a motion to set aside the arbitration agreement, Ms. Nguyen didn't just respond to their motion to compel or the order for an application for arbitration?
Well, it was not being set, and we were trying to get that issue resolved so that the case could move forward.
Did the trial court take the position that they couldn't set it without the movement's consent?
I didn't try to set Mr. Searle's motion. I don't think that works.
Why wouldn't it?
Well,
you wanted it heard.
Usually, if you try to set the other side's motion, the other side complains that, what are you doing setting my motion? I'm going to file for some sort of sanction. That's not your motion. And it just creates a lot of problems. Whereas if you just set the converse, that we're going to rule that you can't, that the arbitration clause is not, doesn't compel arbitration under these circumstances, then you can go ahead and have a hearing on that. And that's what happened. And, of course, everybody, the court points out in the hearing, everybody's there, and all the issues are before the court, the witnesses before the court. Had they brought a witness, I'm sure that they could have introduced testimony as to the circumstances of how this agreement was handled in terms of being translated or explained. But the only witness was Ms. Nguyen, and so... But I think the hearing certainly covered all the relevant issues. Well, I see my time is up, so I was hoping to discuss Haddock versus Quinn, which is a major decision by this case court, but I will sit.
Have your briefing, so thank you very much, sir.
Thank you all very much.
Charles?
This first issue raised by counsel about there being no clear and unmistakable evidence, again, the cases that I've cited to the court, the Ederaldi and Beatty-Ortiz cases from the El Paso Court of Appeals, hold that identical language constitutes clear and unmistakable evidence, as does the Fifth Circuit's Aviles versus Russell Stover Candies case. The question asked by Justice Gabriel about the difference between the contract versus Ms. Nguyen's understanding, yes, as briefed in the appellant's brief, the In re Dillard Department Stores case, an employee, I think, discrimination case from the Texas Supreme Court 2006, this is a quote, "The objective intent as expressed in the agreement controls the construction of an unambiguous contract, not a party's after-the-fact conduct." Justice Kerr had asked about this, and there is a discussion between counsel and the court about this presumption. It is more than a presumption. It is the law, and it must be the law. The Texas law in this state and across the world is and always has been that subjective denials of understanding, self-professed claims of ignorance about the impact and upshot of a contract, cannot be the law. It would be the end of civilization as we know it, because all contracts to purchase anything, I didn't understand when I signed the mortgage that they were going to charge me interest and have the right to foreclose on the property. When I signed the contract to purchase widgets, I didn't really know that they intended for my company to produce widgets for them. It cannot be that an employee, a Spanish-speaking, Vietnamese-speaking, whatever employee, cannot come in after the fact and profess ignorance of understanding of the agreement and thereby void the agreement and be out from underneath.
So an employer has no obligation, in your view, to ensure that its non-English-speaking employees know what they're signing?
An employer, just like any other person on the other end of a contract, a bilateral contract, has no obligation to explain the terms to the other side. That is the law. It has to be the law for the reasons I've just stated. No obligation to explain it to the other side. What the cases that counsel have cited deal with are cases, the Delfingen case, for example, the Valenzuela case from the El Paso Court of Appeals that was discussed by counsel with the court. Specifically in that case, this is on page 803 of the 407 Southwest 3rd, the court points out that in that case, Mr. Valenzuela, the employee, was affirmatively misled about the nature and significance of the arbitration agreement. So, no, there has not been the Howard case that we've cited to the court in our briefing somewhere, Howard, the Guzman case, or page 28 of appellant's brief. There has never been an obligation under Texas law to explain to a non-English speaking or even an illiterate employee, as the employee was in Howard, what the contract is and what its upshot is, what the legal significance of it is. And we've quoted the cases as far back as 1887. I believe there are cases actually from the Republic that I didn't dig up, from the Republic of Texas, that say that no, claiming that you didn't understand the agreement that you signed cannot void the agreement or give you a defense to the agreement. The Prevo case that counsel discussed with you, and this again is a quote from former Judge Kent's opinion, quote, and the person was pressured into signing the agreement quickly. His eerie guess that he made in that case is that the Supreme Court would back away from the rule that we've cited, the Morrison case from 1887, this end of civilization rule that prevents civilization from failing. He says if you're pressured or misled, as in Delfingen, that might be a separate circumstance. The In re Morgan Stanley case discussed is a 2009 decision from the Texas Supreme Court that precedes the 2010 decision by the Supreme Court in Jackson. Most importantly, the distinguishing factor on Morgan is it doesn't involve a delegation provision. There's no delegation provision cited to the court or quoted in any of the opinions, if you go back to look at the Court of Appeals opinion. And finally, this Haddock versus Quinn case from this court is a waiver of litigation conduct case. The distinguishing factor in that case that led to the delegation clause not being enforced was the unique circumstances of that case and the absence in that agreement of a delegation provision like the two that are present here in both the agreement itself and in American Arbitration Association Rule 6. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you both for your argument. It was very helpful. We appreciate it. And your case is submitted, and you are excused to go. We have another argument at 3 o'clock, but we will be in recess until that time.